accuracy errors or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the American Federation of Government Employees Inside Government Program, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power. Now, here's your host, Jason Fornicola.
This week, we'll learn about AFGE's Member Benefits Program with Member Benefits Coordinator Mark Williams and the union's successful efforts to strike down a privatization initiative at the Sacramento International Airport with TSA Local 1230 President James Mudrock. We'll also discuss the state of the labor market with Economic Policy Institute President Larry Michel. But first, Women's Campaign Fund President and CEO Siobhan Sam Bennett joins us. Sam, welcome to the program.
My pleasure, Jason. Thanks so much for having me on.
Sam, we've seen some reports here in the last couple of days, particularly in Politico, about women presidential candidates coming up in 2016. Certainly an interesting topic and one that needs to be discussed. Tell me your thoughts about that process.
Well, right now, the most important thing we've got to do, Jason, is sort of move off this idea, and we all would love to see Hillary Clinton running, but the idea that there's only one woman out there, right, that can run for president. What we need is something the guys have always had, right, a bench of interested and encouraged women to consider run. And we've got a terrific number of emerging women leaders who are primed to be potential presidential candidates in the future, whether it's 2016 or 2020 and beyond. We got to move off this sort of Hillary or nothing kind of mentality that really is in the atmosphere.
So who are some of those other candidates that you think could step in and fill that role if Secretary Clinton decides not to run?
Now, first of all, I'll be very, very clear. We all want Hillary to run. But you've got amazing emerging leaders. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand, who serves in the Senate with distinction. We have Amy Klobuchar. We have, of course, rising star Debbie Wasserman Schultz, though she also, I think, wouldn't she just be a terrific Speaker of the House? And, of course, on the governor level, there are the Republicans, though they are very underrepresented in Congress, they've got some strength on the bench in the gubernatorial mansions across America. You've got Nikki Haley's probably most notable among them from South Carolina. So you've got women on both sides of the aisle who are emerging that they need that encouragement to sort of move forward. Because remember, Jason, there's very important differences with how men and women approach politics.
And I think you bring up a great point there and something that is part of the larger issue, and that is encouraging women candidates to feel empowered to run for public office at any level.
That is absolutely correct. I mean, the pipeline issue is the issue in women's vast underrepresentation in our political system. Now, you know, let's not forget, Jason, we're ranked 95th in the world in the number of women in elected office. I mean, we're behind Cuba and Afghanistan, for crikey's sake, you know? And, you know, research shows, for example, that women vote exponentially better than their male colleagues do on issues from workers' rights to the environment. So one could point to the continuing attacks on the rights of labor having one of their root causes, the underrepresentation of women. And what is that caused by? Women aren't running for office. What's causing that? Well, guys wake up in the morning, Jason, look in the mirror, and they go, ah, see a senator, right? Women need to be asked. And so there are these very profound gender differences in men and women, both how they perform once elected and how they vote and what they care about and what it takes to get them to run.
Let's talk about some of those things specifically on some of these issues. I think one of the important ones is rights for workers in the workplace. Talk about how having a female president would be beneficial to workers in the workplace.
Absolutely. We commissioned some research that it was really clear to us needed to be done to demonstrate what we intuitively knew was the vast difference between men and voting, men's voting records around workers' rights. And we finished that last year, and it had a very clear story it told that women across the board, irregardless of party, Jason, irregardless of value set, voted exponentially better on labor issues than men do, 20 points better on average, in fact. But the real powerful story is about this idea that it's not just Democratic women, right, that you want more of, because actually Democratic women, though they perform better than their male colleagues, it's the Republican women that vastly outperform their male colleagues when it comes to workers' rights. So, you know, you need women on both sides of the aisle, Jason, and we need to be encouraging women. Even a woman, and I'll probably, some of your listeners will probably throw tomatoes at me, but even Michelle Bachmann, because she's a woman, is going to vote better on many issues, or more progressively, for lack of a better word, than her similar conservative male colleague. And that's the change maker. That's the difference maker. So quite frankly, the most important thing the labor movement could be investing in is helping women to advance electorally, because that's where the rubber hits the road for them on both sides of the aisle.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Sam Bennett, the president and CEO of the Women's Campaign Fund, as well as She Should Run. Sam, let's talk a little bit about what your organization's Women's Campaign Fund and She Should Run are doing to further women to feel empowered to run for office.
Well, we are the oldest organization, Jason, that financially supports women when they run for office. And we've been doing that in a very special way, which is encouraging women at the very beginning of their political careers. For example, we found, it wasn't me personally, of course, but, you know, Women's Campaign Fund found Tammy Baldwin back when she was a county supervisor, I believe was her position, and brought her to D.C. and said, "You got to run for higher office, girlfriend." And as she says, you know, 2 years later, she finally got religion and did it, and Women's Campaign Fund trained her, funded her. And that's when she ran for the state House, state Senate, you know, U.S. Congress, U.S. Senate. The rest is history. So it's that early, early political career investment. And also on our She Should Run side, Jason, it's getting women to start thinking about running for office. The truth of the matter is, you know, women need to be asked on average 6 times before they even consider a run for office. And there are obstacles like the incredible sexism that women face along the way that not only hurts them when they run, hurts them when they serve, but also keeps them from running in the first place. So we have initiatives like Name It, Change It to fight that sexism, which was enormously successful this past election cycle. So we have programs like She Should Run, getting women to think about running. We've got Name It, Change It to fight sexism. And the other key thing is letting women know all the other organizations and resources that are out there for them, which we also do with She Should Run. And then the other key piece of this, Jason, is women don't invest financially in politics the way their male counterparts do. And our continuing Vote With Your Purse research tracks that. And now we also track what PACs give to women relative to men, and keep our eye on that ball to make sure that women are getting what they deserve from the PACs when they finally make that decision to run.
Sam, we've seen, obviously, tremendous gridlock in Washington trying to get things done. How would a female voice, a woman influence, help further that process along and break away with some of that gridlock?
Bingo. You wouldn't even have gridlock. This is very, very substantiated, Jason, by research. Women are far more likely than their male colleagues to reach across the aisle, to collaborate, to join together to do what needs to be done to pass legislation that helps their constituents and helps the nation at large. Men tend to, because, you see, men run for office because they see it as a pathway to power, and research, again, substantiates this. Women run because they want to change the world. So very different drivers for men and women. And so women are really willing to do what's necessary to get the job done, where men are far more likely to get pulled into those partisan traps and those power systems than women are. So if you had more women, Jason, you know, if we had as many women in office as like Iceland does, let's say, we wouldn't even have gridlock, Jason.
Sam, obviously, a lot of the focus here is on 2016 and what's going to happen in the presidential race. But before that, we've got to get through the midterm elections. How is your organization gearing up for the midterms?
Well, there's a real critical problem that's been brewing on the horizon, Jason, and that is the lack of women, the decline of women running at the state level. And it's a huge problem because that's sort of the farm team for the federal races. So, and of course, on the state level is where a lot of battles are fought, right? Right to work legislation and other legislation, it's all fought on a state by state level. So we're going to be focusing a lot of our attention because we endorse at all levels. We're going to be focusing a lot of energy on the state level. And in addition to that, one of the big problems, and one of the strategic reasons why extremists have been successful in sort of pulling agendas to the right, is the lack of women, the precipitous decline of women in the Republican Party. And so as a bipartisan organization, there's a long history of supporting moderate Republican women like Olympia Snow, like Susan Collins, like, quite frankly, Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. We are going to be making it part of our agenda to create safe haven and encouragement for moderate Republican women to get out there and run and create help working with other sister allies to get funding streams for those women, because very often their own parties won't support them.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next we'll discuss the labor market with Economic Policy Institute President Larry Mischel.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Larry Mischel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. Larry, welcome back to the program.
Great to be with you.
Now, the most recent jobs report showed that the labor market added 155,000 jobs in December, with unemployment rate holding steady at about 7.8%. What's your analysis of this?
Well, that's about the rate of job growth we've had in the prior 6 months, and it represents a rate of job growth that's not bad compared to what we've done, but really insufficient to what we need and what a really strong recovery would look like. So basically, with the job growth at this pace, we're not going to reach full employment until sometime in the 2020s. So that's not really acceptable. We have 7.8% unemployment is the equal to the worst unemployment rate of the last recession. So we've had, obviously, a very deep and extended recession with unemployment reaching as high as 10%. But, you know, the last recession, right, it peaked at 7.8%. So this is really, you know, still a horrible situation. We need to get the unemployment rate down to, you know, somewhere between 4 and 5%. And you know, this affects a whole lot of people. I think people mistake the fact that when you have 7.8% unemployed, they think 92% of the people are okay, which is not actually true, because you know, roughly 8% are unemployed. We have an underemployment rate closer to 15%, which includes people working part-time that want a full-time job, people who have dropped out of the labor force. Plus, there's a lot of people who come in and out of unemployment over the year, right? Someone unemployed now may have a job in 2 months and someone else becomes unemployed. So we basically have probably 20 to 25% of the people are unemployed or underemployed at some point during the year. In addition, other people are affected by the deep unemployment, such as those who are suffering wage cuts and loss of benefits, fewer hours of work, et cetera. So this is really weighing us down as a nation. It really disproportionately affects people without a college degree, minorities. And so to me, job number one in this country is how do we rapidly get the unemployment rate down?
Larry, what is the acceptable level of unemployment in this country? If we're at 7.8% now, is there a number that the country looks at as a whole and says, we can live with that?
Yes, I think, well, there's going to be debate about this. But you should remember that in the spring of 2007, we had an unemployment rate of, I think it was 4.4%. I mean, there's no reason we shouldn't get back to that. So we are pretty far off that. And the reason why something like 4.4% is okay, because there's always people going to be quitting jobs or coming into the labor force, looking for a job the first time and counted as unemployed. So there's always going to be some unemployment. That's to be expected. The question is, do we have unemployment because we're not producing as much as we could or we can get it down further?
Let's talk a little bit about wages. Where do they stand right now in terms of where they used to be?
Well, wage growth has been awful for almost every group of workers, and it's not just due to the recession. So over the last 10 years, basically since 2002 or 2003, there's been no improvement of wages relative to inflation, right? The purchasing power of people's wages and benefits has not improved, including over the last recovery from 2002 to 2007. And that includes not just blue-collar workers, but also white-collar workers. People with a college degree have not seen their wages grow faster than inflation for 10 years. In fact, the bottom 70% of college graduates have stagnant or falling wages at this time. And the recession only exacerbates that because when there's high unemployment, employers don't feel any pressure to provide wages to keep people on the job or to attract workers to their firm.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Larry Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. Larry, EPI issued a report recently on this very topic and found that the public sector lost 13,000 jobs in December, bringing its total to 645,000 jobs lost since the start of the recovery. And it's important to note here that your organization found 21,000 of those jobs were in the federal sector. Talk to me about the significance of those numbers and ultimately the impact on public service.
Well, one of the interesting things about this recovery is that we've actually had faster private sector job growth than in the last two recoveries, but total jobs have not grown as quickly. And that's because in the federal sector, but even more than the federal sector, the state and local sector has been losing a lot of jobs. That in most recoveries, we see state and local employment expand, more teachers, more firefighters, more workers for state governments. It's gone the other way this time because of the tremendous financial crises facing states because of the recession. I mean, when you have a recession, they lose a lot of revenue. When there's not as much business going on, there's not as much income generated, there's not as much taxes being paid. That creates deficit problems for states, and they are obligated in 49 of the 50 states to have a balanced budget every year. So they have to either raise taxes or cut spending. And they've been doing that. And what's interesting to note is that when the states do that, for every job that's lost that's an actual government employee, there's another job that's lost in the private sector. And that's because the cutbacks in federal budgets and state budgets is not just for the work that they do directly in providing good services to people, but they also contract out. A lot of health care is contracted out, obviously. Building roads and bridges is contracted out. And when the people that are laid off directly and those jobs that are lost from through the contractors, those people are not out buying things in the economy, and that creates even more job losses. So we've calculated that, you know, if we were to provide aid to state and local governments, for instance, for every public sector job you get, you also get an additional private sector. And this is what distinguishes this recovery, and the importance to answering your question is that in this recovery, it's the you know, you take one step forward in the private sector, but you end up taking a half step backwards from the loss of jobs due to the government sector, and that's really holding us back.
What then is your response, is EPI's response, to get people working again, and what are some of the sectors that we should be focusing on to create jobs?
Well, the first point is we can't get to where we want to go without rapidly getting the unemployment rate down and creating jobs. And where we want to go in terms is getting an economy with shared prosperity, with everybody growing their incomes along with the growth of the economy, and to have a fiscally sustainable situation at the state and local sector or at the federal sector. There's no way you can get the deficit down without having many more jobs and a much bigger economy. We had a federal deficit of just about of 1.2% of GDP, which is a very small number, in 2007 before the recession. Most of the high deficits that seems to concern people now, where our deficit runs around $1 trillion, is primarily because we have a slack economy. So the first thing to do if you want to really care about deficits, the first thing you do is you get jobs going. Now, how can you do that? Well, the reason we have such high unemployment is that there's a shortfall in the demand for goods and services. We had lost a lot of housing wealth. We lost some stock wealth. It's coming back now. People are not spending like they used to. And when that happens, you know, businesses aren't selling and they're not employing people. So what we have to do is we have to increase expenditure in the economy. And the way the government can, if the private sector isn't doing it, the government can step in and do that. It does it through a number of different ways. One is it can directly spend in the economy. You can we can do clean energy projects. We can do infrastructure projects. It can also does it by doing things like giving the unemployed unemployment benefits, which is both compassionate, but also those people are going to spend that money because they're not going to save it. They're not trying to invest it. They're trying to just keep their family and household together. So they spend it. When they spend it, you know, they walk into the local drugstore, the supermarket, and that creates jobs, you know, all over the economy. You know, there's other ways to create jobs, too. I wish we did a program where we actually gave money to the state and local sector to directly hire people to do things that are not now done. Then people would absolutely observe the government creating jobs. They would know that they were created, and we can fulfill needs that really go unmet.
Larry Michel, the president of the Economic Policy Institute. Larry, great to have you back on the program again. Thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll learn about a key win against privatization with AFGE TSA Local 1230 President James Munrock.
Attention AFGE members. Are you in need of a new computer or home appliance but can't spare the upfront cash? Discover Purchasing Power, an exclusive benefit that allows you to buy brand name electronics, furniture, and more through easy payroll allotment. With no upfront cash or credit check required and 12 months to pay, Purchasing Power gives you a better way to buy. AFGE members receive an 8% discount over what other federal employees pay. Learn more at afge.org/purchasingpower.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by James Mudrock, the president of AFGE's Transportation Security Administration, Local 1230. James, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
James, the union is celebrating a key win against privatization efforts at the Sacramento International Airport, where your local represents TSOs. Tell me about the situation and what happened there.
Well, roughly a year ago, we discovered, and this pretty much flew under everyone's radar, that the airport authority here had requested the authorization from the county board of supervisors, which controls the airport, to seek privatization. The way they did that was not to present it in a public hearing or put it up for, you know, any kind of discussion. They snuck it through on the consent calendar. Well, nobody really reads the consent calendar, and so nobody really was aware of it for a few days. When we found out, I think the two most important things that we did were contacted AFGE in Washington. We put a team together of people, and, you know, I want to thank those people, Charity Wilson, Emily Ryan, Tim Shurrock, Ryan Mims, I know I'm probably forgetting someone, but hopefully I'll remember. But anyway, they did a great job of helping us get organized, get our facts together. Local 1230 had only been in existence as a local for a couple of months when this happened, and so this is, everything was pretty much new to us. So getting direction from AFG headquarters, very valuable to us. The other thing we did was get in contact with the Labor Council here in Sacramento. We have an excellent relationship with them. We've been part of that organization since we were, actually even before we were Local 1230, when we were still part of Local 1234. And they were just instrumental in getting us in contact with the board members and getting meetings with them and getting the ball rolling to reversing this process.
James, as you were going along on this year-long lobbying process and public campaign, when did you start to think that you were changing some minds and that you had a chance to have this vote overturned?
It took a while. We had one champion on the county board pretty much from the beginning, another that we felt pretty confident about, and three that that we had to do some work on. It probably wasn't until about the end of the summer that we felt we had support from a third member. But even then, one thing we found out was that politicians can be very hard to pin down to commitments sometimes, especially in election years. And so the process continued to drag out. I think that in a way it was beneficial to us that the process took as long as it did, because the two key elements of our eventually being successful happened fairly late in the year. One was that the airport director, who had been pushing for the SPP, retired and left the airport effective December 15th. And nobody was sorry to see him go, to be honest. The other was that the GAO put out a report just a few weeks ago which questioned a lot of the SPP process. It strongly questioned whether there was any evidence of any, you know, advantage to an airport privatizing, and getting this in the hands of the Board of Supervisors, I think, really, really cemented the deal.
James, let's talk a little bit about the dangers of privatizing an airport. What kind of dangers are associated with that sort of activity?
Well, there's a big difference between running an organization or running a security operation where your main focus is security and running one where your main focus is making a profit. And I don't believe that when it comes to a question of profit or security, that security is going to be the first factor that's considered. You know, I believe that a private company will find every way possible to squeeze the operation, and I don't think that's good for security. Also, adding a private contractor adds a layer of it adds another layer between headquarters and the field. If we had, you know, some important information come out today, it could be pretty much directly passed right down the line to the officers on the floor without having to go through an intermediary process, you know, of working through a contractor.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with James Mudrock, the president of AFGE Transportation Security Administration, Local 1230. James, what kind of message does this send to other airport authorities around the country that might be planning similar privatization initiatives?
Well, I think they need to take a very careful look at any proposed advantage, particularly in light of the GAO report, which shows that they have not really been able to identify any. And TSA has come a long way and is continuing to grow as an agency and improve our processes and our communications. And, you know, it's a situation, and this was something that came up, these exact words came up at the board meeting several times yesterday. If something's not broken, why would you want to fix it?
James, I want to go back to something that you said earlier, and that was that when your local took on this task, it was only in existence for a couple of months, Local 1230. Talk about the initiative by your members to dive into this and try to get a change pushed through.
Well, there was, you know, an overwhelming feeling among our members that privatization was not something they wanted. You know, our members appreciate being federal officers. It's something we're proud of, and turning over to a private contractor was not something we felt would be good for us either as individuals or as a security force. A lot of our members had previously worked for private contractors back in the pre-9/11 days when security was done by a private operation at Sacramento, and none of them had any good things to say about that experience. All of them, you know, felt much better off as federal officers.
James, what are the next steps at the airport now that the vote has been overturned by the board?
The airport is directed to contact TSA headquarters and request that the application be withdrawn. The airport is currently in the process of seeking a new airport director. We have been given a very gracious opportunity by the county executive to have someone from the Labor Council sit in as part of the screening process for the new director. It's obviously a major issue for us when in that process is going to be privatization, and we will certainly do everything we can to bring in someone who would never mention this again.
James Mudrock, the president of AFGE's Transportation Security Administration, Local 1230. James, thank you for coming on the program, and congratulations on this significant win.
Thank you. We're very excited out here. And again, I want to say thank you to AFGE in Washington for providing a lot of guidance and assistance for us.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and up next, we'll discuss AFGE's Member Benefits Program with Member Benefits Coordinator Mark Williams.
Planning a family vacation? Did you know through your AFGE membership, you are eligible for discounts for you and your family when you travel to Busch Gardens, Adventure Island, Knott's Berry Farm, and SeaWorld? And if you want to capture those family moments on film, your union membership will help you get a discount on a camcorder or digital camera. Those are just some of the benefits offered by the American Federation of Government Employees, the nation's largest federal workers union, representing some 600,000 workers nationwide. If you are a member, simply go to the AFGE website and click on the Member Benefits tab or call 888-844-2343. That's 888-844-2343. Not a member? Become one. Log on to AFGE.org and click the Join AFGE button on the homepage. AFGE, proud to make America work.
Welcome back to AFGE's Inside Government, available on demand at InsideGovernmentRadio.com. We've been joined by Mark Williams, AFGE's National Benefits Coordinator. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Jason, for having me.
Mark, in addition to AFGE representing its members legally, legislatively on Capitol Hill, and in the press, the union also has a robust member benefits program, from insurance and career services to a dedicated mortgage program. Tell me about the program as a whole and what you do for AFGE's members.
The member benefit program was developed in order to make membership more valuable to our members. If a member uses one or two of the benefit programs, they can find that the cost of their annual dues is almost free. No dues are used towards administering or supporting these benefits, and AFGE doesn't profit from them. They're heavily invested in customer service because they're really designed to be a tool to organize and to retain members. So if they don't work, we don't want them.
How many benefits are available to the members through the program?
The last time I did it, it was over 60. But we add some all the time, and sometimes some are combined, or we drop them if they're not living up to the expectations that our members deserve.
Now, you have been at work at this program for decades, and I'm wondering if you can give me a sense for a couple of the most popular programs that are available.
Well, the most popular benefit is our Purchasing Power program, where members purchase major appliances, televisions, and computers through payroll deduction with no credit check. There are other programs that are equally as popular and maybe as important, such as our scholarship programs that we have for our members. We have a mortgage program. We have legal services program, which is heavily utilized. There are just a number of benefits that span the gamut of what our members might need, and that's why we have such an array. Not everybody is buying a house every week, but they certainly may need pet insurance, for instance, for their dog or their cat, which we provided a discount.
Specifically, let's start talking about some of these one by one. I know that there is a discounted electricity benefit available to our members in a number of deregulated states. What can you tell us about that?
Well, actually, it's a brand new program we have not yet introduced. We will be rolling this out within the next, I would say, 30 to 60 days. And electricity has been deregulated in, I'll list the states: New York, New Jersey, Maryland, Washington, D.C., Delaware, Pennsylvania, Texas, Illinois, Massachusetts, Connecticut, Rhode Island, and Ohio. And for members who live in those states, AFGE has done something historic. It has not been done with any other union, and to my knowledge, it has not been done with any other group of consumers. But we have partnered with an energy outfit to provide our members a discounted electric rate. In these states where it's only available in these states where there has been deregulation allowing the competition to occur. And what we plan on doing is introducing this program by way of a postcard, and it'll direct our members, please go to the website and check it out and see if you can save some money. The chances are extremely good, like 9 out of 10 times our members will save money, and in some cases significant money on their electric bill, even though it's hard to think about it right now. And this chilly winter, when it comes summertime for the air conditioning years, it'll make an enormous difference.
It sounds like a tremendous benefit for federal employees who, of course, as our audience knows, is under a two-year pay freeze and constantly under the threat of benefit reduction in the federal workforce. This must be something that could be very popular to them to be able to lower that monthly bill.
Well, this one thing about electric bills is that just about everybody I've ever met or known has to pay some kind of electric bill. So this is a universal bill. The only unfortunate thing is that it's only available in those states that I mentioned. Too bad it is not a deregulated program throughout the country. But that's why we need to target this through email and through postcards just to the people who live in those states. But I do believe it's going to be an important benefit, providing significant value to only our members. And you have to be a member to qualify.
You're listening to AFGE's Inside Government, and we're here with Mark Williams, AFGE's National Benefits Coordinator. Mark, the ability to further one's education is certainly a powerful tool, and AFGE, and in fact, has an educational benefit through Grantham University. Tell me a little bit about the benefit and, of course, the scholarship opportunity that's available.
Yeah, we have a relationship with Grantham for several years now. And they're an institution that provides bachelor degrees and master degrees completely online at our members' own pace. We've had a very successful relationship. And, well, 2 years ago, we introduced a scholarship program through Grantham. And this year, we've had our second winner. Sandra K. Brown of Grandview, Missouri, wanted to get her master's degree, and she applied for the scholarship and won, and her scholarship is valued at like $14,000, and it'll cover the cost of her tuition, technology fees, textbooks, and the software. And as well, we also gave her a laptop to help her in her studies.
$14,000 is a significant contribution to one's education.
Well, it certainly is. And last year, the winner was somebody who won a four-year scholarship, and its value was $36,000. So I think the important thing is to remember is that those members of ours who are interested in a higher education and want to apply for the scholarship should go to the AFGE website. They can actually apply for it now. We'll be announcing the winner later this year in 2013. But now's a good time to scope it out and see what's required.
Are you aware of any deadlines that are associated with the scholarship?
The best thing to do would be to go to the AFGE website. The deadline requirements and the entry requirements are all listed and clearly there, as well as the link that they'll need.
How frequently are the scholarships awarded?
The Grantham scholarship for the member is awarded once a year. Now, the other thing about Grantham University, the scholarship is limited only to members. But if our member has a spouse or a child who wants to take some online courses, they are entitled to the significant discount that we've arranged. And this discount basically is the equivalent to, well, most people are familiar with Phoenix University, online university. Grantham University tuition for AFGE members is roughly about half the cost of what it would cost at Phoenix University.
Speaking of scholarships, Mark, Union Plus offers one as well. Tell us about that and the winners that we've had this year.
Yeah, Union Plus is part of the AFL-CIO, and they manage the credit card portfolio. Our current credit card is actually now with Capital One. And through our contract with the bank, they are required to put up money that we provide as scholarships to our members. And every year, this scholarship program is opened up to many unions, and we get a lot of applications. And AFG is fortunate that out of the, I think, 8,000 applicants, we had three winners. which actually exceeded most unions. Didn't have three. They may have had one, or they had none. AFG was fortunate enough to have three. And Eve Chase of Springfield, Virginia, who's the daughter of Tana Addy, a member of AFG Local 3615, she received $500. Adia Coleman of Silver Spring, daughter of Denise Burris, who is a member of AFG Local 1000, she received a $1,000 scholarship. And finally, our member Selena Upton of Columbus, Georgia, member of Local 54, received a $500 scholarship. This, again, this scholarship is open once a year, and the deadline for filing is January 31st, and the winner is usually announced in June 1st. Again, information on this program, and to apply, you have to apply online, but that's all available at the website under the member benefits at www.afge.org.
Mark, another popular benefit at AFGE year after year is the Holiday Bonus Bucks campaign, which is, in fact, still going. Tell us about the program.
Yeah, Bonus Bucks campaign is a member-to-member organizing drive. The theory behind that, of course, as you know, our membership is our strength. And the greater our membership, the greater our strength. So organizing new members is all important to what we need to do on Capitol Hill. And in order to facilitate building our membership, we always thought, well, if just one member got one other member, we could double our membership. And based on that theory, we developed the Bonus Bucks campaign. And it's a member-to-member campaign where a member will go out and recruit a coworker. And as well as getting all the benefits of union membership, the recruiter will get a $20 incentive. Cash, actually, a check, is mailed to them. And most districts, I think almost all of them, will match that $20 and add an additional $30. And what this means is if a member goes out and recruits their coworker, they will get a check in the mail for $50. If they recruit three members, they will get a check for $150. And there's no limit. You can recruit as many members as you can. And the top recruiter this year, the top recruiter in each district, in each one of our 12 districts, is going to receive an iPad, a brand new iPad. That is the big incentive. So we're giving away 12 of those. And in the past, we've had very successful campaigns. Last Bonus Bucks we had a year ago, we recruited 6,000 new members through this program. So our members obviously find it not only lucrative but fun. A lot of them have a lot of fun doing it. Information on the program is on the website and the forms that you need, or just call the membership and organizing department. We'll be glad to help you out. And that number is 202-639-6410. But the Bonus Bucks campaign, it began on November 12th, and it runs through March 29th.
So plenty of time left if someone still wants to get involved.
Yeah, and not only make some money, but maybe win an iPad.
How long has the campaign been going?
In various formats, and it's evolved over time. I would say at least 10 to 12 years now. It's one of the reasons, you know, when we pour money back into our members, AFG is one of the few unions that a big chunk of its per capita tax is returned to the members in terms of cash bonuses, and this is one example. And it's a reason that AFGE is one of the very few unions that has grown consistently in the last few years. One of the top three, actually, if not the number one union.
And it sounds like a reason for that is this tremendous membership benefit program that AFGE provides.
Well, I think benefits play a key role in membership growth. I think when people find out what AFGE does for them on Capitol Hill and what they do for them on the job site and how the contract is negotiated on their behalf and the grievance procedures where they're represented to make sure that they're treated fairly, add to that the economic benefit of over 60 programs that really more than cover the cost of someone's dues. To me, it's a no-brainer. Why wouldn't you join AFGE? And AFGE is one of the greatest democracies I've ever seen. The due structure is set by each local. the local determines how those dues are spent. And our convention every 3 years, that's where the members decide in the direction and the policies and the officers of this union. It's a marvelous organization, and I think our biggest challenge is to let other people know just exactly who and what we do.
Mark, you mentioned earlier the AFGE credit card, AFGE Union Plus credit card. Tell us a little bit about that. I understand there was a switch made from HSBC to Capital One and a couple of improvements that were incorporated there.
Yeah, AFGE, actually one of the first benefit programs that was ever introduced was a credit card. And back in the late 80s, credit cards were charging enormous rates of interest and were very lucrative for banks. Competition has grown enormously, which anybody can tell by looking at their mailbox and seeing how many offers they get. But from day one, AFGE always provided a credit card that was better for the members in terms of benefits, in terms of customer service, in terms of services. And we've switched banks a few times in order to improve the card. And the latest transition was from HSBC to Capital One. And so far, the transition has gone very smoothly. And it's also, the program has been enhanced. There's been an elimination of phone fees. If you pay by check or phone, there's no fees. There's elimination of foreign transaction fees, reduced fees for check use. And I think most importantly, switching to Capital One, almost 75% of the accounts that we have experienced a rate decrease on an average of 2% charged on their daily balance. So we're feeling good about it. We hope to let more people know about the card and how unique it is and some of the benefits so more people have the advantage of carrying a union card.
Mark, for our AFGE listeners out there, any of them who have been to a national convention or various other events that the union holds throughout the year will know that there are no shortages of products available at these events. Tell us a little bit about the online store and how that came about to make them available to the members.
Sure, Jason. We have a number of AFGE items, T-shirts and pens and clocks and watches and cosmetic bags now and aluminum bottles. There are over 70 different items, even more than that if you get into the various clothing options. We sell these items at our cost. They're union-made, and if we can't get them union-made, they are USA-made. But they all support labor, and they support the United States workforce. And we sell them basically for what they cost us. The purpose is to spread our AFG name, make it visible in the workplace. One way to do that is to wear that AFG T-shirt or hat or scarf and carry that AFG mug. And we make that as easy as possible for locals and for members to obtain. Again, in events like our convention, we set up booths. We will have one at the legislative conference coming up. But 24 hours a day on our online store. And anybody can visit the store at afgestore.org. Drop-down menu, customer service, all items are guaranteed. Check it out.
Mark Williams, AFGE's National Benefits Coordinator. Mark, always fun to have you on the program. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks for letting me be here.
Thank you to our guest this week, Women's Campaign Fund President and CEO Siobhan Sam Bennett, Economic Policy Institute President Larry Michel, AFGE TSA Local 1230 President James Mudrock, and AFGE Member Benefits Coordinator Mark Williams. I'm your host, Jason Fornicola, and that's The View from Inside Government.
Thank you for listening to Inside Government, brought to you in part by Purchasing Power.
FederalNewsRadio.com, your source for federal news now.
WFED Washington, WW.